Urban Emerging Voices Fellowship is a literary mentorship that provides new writers the tools to launch a professional writing career.
Emerging Voices is the most amazing program that allows the writers to develop.
It's the opportunity to have my work in the world, to get to the truth of my writing, to know that what I'm writing matters.
Sit here talking for like 45 minutes.
I know.
I get home to edit it and it's like there's nothing.
There's nothing there.
Do you have that too?
I do. I do have that fear.
Have you done podcasts yourself?
Yeah, I tried to start a podcast at one point, like interviewing people in the book industry who like don't normally get interviewed.
Okay.
So like sales reps and like, yeah, you know, the PR person who works at Simon & Schuster and like,
yeah,
you know, the international rights person or whatever. Like, I was just like, tell me about your job.
Right. All those behind the scenes people we never meet.
Well, because like, I feel like one of the things that I really like feel about authors is that they don't understand how many people are constantly working for them.
Right.
Like, so, and like, and I get that sometimes it doesn't feel that way. And I get that sometimes your book is not the book that's on the forefront of everyone's mind. But like, I think, like, if authors knew how many conversations we have about their books day in and day out, like,
right,
they would maybe feel, I don't know, I hear a lot
more
of authors
special, less inclined to feel like nothing's happening.
Well, and, like, I get the feeling, I, like, understand where they come from when they talk about, like, I hear a lot of author complaints about, like, my publisher didn't do anything, and I'm like, even if it seems like they didn't do anything, they did a ton.
Yeah.
It, just the fact that your book exists and is, like, on a website, particularly if it's on, like, Amazon and Barnes & Noble and stuff like that, like, that's a tremendous amount of work.
Yeah. So, welcome, everyone, to the episode 009 of the Emerging Voices podcast. And if you haven't guessed, we're here with Julia Callahan.
Hi!
Hi! So, I'm going to read your instructor bio, because you're now teaching at UCLA in the Extension Writers Program.
Kind of.
We'll go back to that.
Mm-hmm.
But it says, it's telling me here that Julia Callahan is the acquisitions editor and director of sales and marketing for Rare Bird Books, a literary publicity and events firm. We're going to skip that other sentence. And she helped run the events department at Book Soup for 4 years. Julie, are you doing an event for Festival of Books?
We have a booth.
Moderating? You have a booth.
Excuse me. We have a booth.
You have moderated a panel for us for AWP.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. I'm happy to moderate things when people ask.
Well, you are actually, I think that Julia has become a friend of mine through the fellowship.
Yes.
And it has actually been through meeting you at panels,
yeah,
listening to you moderate, and just me being like, this person is rad, and I want to hang out with them,
yeah,
outside of Penn. So,
which we have done and had a very good time.
We have done, and we have theoretically made plans for Drag Queen Bingo.
Which needs to happen soon.
Needs to happen
Jesus.
Soon. It's going to be amazing.
Yeah. Can't wait.
Julia, how are you doing?
I'm good, man. I'm good. I, you know, work is busy as usual. Life is, you know, life.
You're the hardest working woman in show business, as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm working with my therapist on whether or not that's a compliment or not right now.
I totally understand that, because I feel like you and I have had this conversation before where it's,
yeah,
like, we have to be realistic about, like, separate the love of the art and,
yes,
like, the job.
Exactly.
Yeah. So tell us your backstory. Like, tell us how you came to be at Rare Bird.
Sure. I mean, my backstory is that I love books. I grew up my mom used to take me to a bookstore every weekend and we would sit and read books. And so I've always been a book person and I have a degree in English literature. And
tell us where you grew up.
I grew up in Santa Cruz, California,
yes,
which is a really, can I cuss on this?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, a really fucking crazy place. I always like to check.
Yeah,
a really fucking crazy place to be from.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people know it as, like, a place that they went as a kid. They went to the boardwalk, or they, like, maybe they went to college there, or they spent a few summers there, or something like that. Like, when you're actually from Santa Cruz, it is a bananas place to be from.
How would people from, maybe not from California, from other places in the world even,
yeah,
have heard of Santa Cruz?
It's, I mean, if you've seen The Lost Boys,
mm-hmm,
you have seen Santa Cruz,
okay,
because that's where it's filmed.
Right.
And Us, Jordan Peele's new movie, was filmed there, too.
So, two kind of terrifying things.
Yeah, I mean, it's got, like, a horror background. I mean, you and I are my favorite murder fans.
Yeah.
And there were two working serial killers in Santa Cruz when my parents moved there, which is, like, I could do a whole podcast about that.
Right.
You've probably heard it about it in a Beach Boys song, right, or in, you know, it's like, it's a, O'Neill, if you've worn O'Neill's anything, it's, that's from Santa Cruz.
Right, yeah.
Jack O'Neill was a buddy of my dad's, you know, like.
And what'd your dad do?
My dad is a local celebrity.
Yes.
In Santa Cruz. Mm-hmm. His name is Bill the Oyster Man.
Okay.
And he runs an oyster business. He ran a farm when I was a kid up in Tomales Bay, which is just north of San Francisco. And now he caters all over the Silicon Valley and Bay Area with oysters.
So you're OG California.
OG. My grandparents immigrated from Italy to California.
Okay.
I'm not a New York Italian, and they never were.
Right.
And so they've been here for three generations. You know, my mother was born here, and then I was born here. And then my dad, his family's Washington, so right. OG West Coast.
Okay.
So
that's the backstory for you being in bookstores every weekend.
Bookstores. My mom, the one thing my mom never said no to me about, she, you know, my mom like denied me many, many, many things, but she always bought me books.
Okay.
If I wanted them, I used to like win all the like library reading events in the summer, like one free pizza or something.
Right.
And then I got a degree in English literature at UC Santa Cruz. And then moved to Los Angeles, and I was working in film and television, and I really, really, really hated it.
Okay.
Is that
why you moved to LA?
No, I didn't want to be in San Francisco because everyone I knew moved to San Francisco. I wanted to be in a big city, and I wanted to be in California.
Yeah.
So LA seemed like the logical choice. Also, my dad hates Los Angeles and grew up here. And at age 21, there was like a bit of a fuck you happening.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I was like, well, I'm just going to move to the place you hate.
Well, it's so interesting to me because you're one of my friends I know that loves Los Angeles.
Yes, I do. I absolutely love it.
Right.
Yeah.
And why do you love LA so much?
It's just, I grew up in a place that hated Los Angeles. Like,
right,
you are trained to hate Los Angeles.
Right.
And so when I first came here, you know, I always joke, like, you know, the first like 17 years of my life, I would say I hated Los Angeles, and really I had only ever been to Disneyland.
Right.
And so, right. I'd been to Orange County,
right,
which I still do not, I'm not a huge fan of. I won't say I hate it because it's got some redeeming qualities now.
And it's changing.
It is changing.
Okay.
And man, if it doesn't, we love you, Orange County, and you have, your Mexican food sometimes beats Los Angeles straight out the water.
Mm-hmm.
So I when I was a little bit older, when I was in college, I had roommates who were from Southern California, and I started visiting them like during the summers and stuff. And we would come to actual LA, and I was like, oh, it's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Like, I kind of like this.
Yeah.
And then coming from the Bay Area, LA was very inexpensive. I mean, I understand that that's a crazy thing to say. But when you come from,
like, a while ago,
13 years ago,
yeah,
but also even back then, when you come from the Bay Area, LA was still monumentally cheaper.
Right.
And like, it is still cheaper, but it's not as crazy cheaper.
Yeah.
So for me, like, moving here right after college was like, I could find an apartment that I could live in and afford. Kind of cobbled together jobs. I at one point was working like four different jobs at the same time.
So you came here for film and television.
I came here and ended up in film and television.
Okay. So that was before the cobbled together four jobs?
Well, it was kind of wild. So I was,
okay.
Tell us
about the job.
Yeah, I used to give the Paramount Studio tour,
okay,
which I'm still awesome at.
Oh my God, I love to know that. We're totally doing that.
Oh, I can give you
way in.
I can give you the best tour of most
Amazing.
Of Los Angeles.
Okay. You heard it here,
I
folks.
Used to, my dad's best friend in high school, his family owns a liquor store on Fairfax and Sunset called Almore Liquors.
Okay.
I delivered liquor for them for a minute second. I worked part-time on the weekends at Book Soup,
okay,
and that's sort of how it was my inroad. I was a production assistant on some different television shows, some terrible reality shows
yeah.
that we'll all would rather forget ever happened. And I worked audience coordination on certain shows and stuff like that. Like, I just kind of did all sorts of stuff. Yeah. And then, and I was a production assistant at a, like, commercial house, a place that did film commercials.
Okay.
Or filmed commercials and stuff. Book Soup was the job I liked the best.
Okay.
Out of that. And
Book Soup is a bookstore in Hollywood.
Yeah, Book Soup is in West Hollywood. It's, you know, old LA bookstore, started in the 70s, and it's just, like, has a great, like, New York bookstore vibe. It's floor-to-ceiling books. I really loved that. I've always felt most comfortable in a bookstore. Mm-hmm. When I was in college, I did my junior year abroad in London, and when I was feeling homesick, I would either go to the Thames, because I grew up next to the beach, yeah. So, like, water makes me very comfortable, or I would, like, go into Waterstones and just, like, look at the fiction section.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't even have to buy anything. I just, like, it like calmed me to be with the books.
Yeah.
You know, and so Book Soup always felt very comfortable for me. The person who I still work for now was the events coordinator. His name's Tyson Cornell. He was the events coordinator there, and he realized that I was very good at running events.
Okay.
And I have a theory that, of course, my father ran this company that was catering.
Yeah.
What is catering if not an event? And the only thing you need to do to be good at running an event is to not freak out when things go wrong.
Totally. Yeah.
Because they're always going to go wrong. Always. Yep. And so you just, if you are a person who can, like, not freak when that happens, you're good.
Yeah.
Good to go.
Yeah.
So I had spent all of college running my dad's business, so I was very good at this.
Yeah.
And, Tyson sort of realized that, and with my schedule, he was like, well, you should start doing the events after you get off. I was working at the Dr. Phil show at the time.
Of course.
Mostly. I'm not going to disparage him on this podcast,
right.
But
we love you, Dr. Phil.
Yeah. Someone buy me a drink sometime. I'll tell you all about
it.
Yeah. So I just ended up doing the events after that. Like, I would come to Book Soup at 5 and do the event that night, and I loved it.
So when you say do the event,
yeah.
Tell the people what that means.
Okay, so, I mean, part of it is just, like, very logistical. It's, like, moving chairs into a place where people can sit, making sure the microphone works and is on. And then also there's, like, other parts of it where you're, like, greeting the author and making sure they're comfortable and, you know, making sure books are where they need to be and... And, you know,
sure you have the books?
Make sure, well, yeah,
is that
that's,
your job?
Eventually that became my job.
It wasn't at the time.
Yeah. When I was just running the events, it was like, I just came in and ran the event.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's like a meeting.
Yeah. And it was like, what's so nice. I mean, like, there's like a part of me that, like, I like, you know, I mean, I don't want to go back to what my salary was at that point, but there's a part of me that's like, I just, like, went in, did the thing, left, did not think about work again.
Yeah.
God, a fucking miracle that was.
That sounds so nice.
I'm just going to move. Yeah. I'm going to stop talking for a second. I'm going to move because my leg's asleep.
I can cut that out.
That's why I stopped talking. But so, you don't have to cut it out either. You can, we can be super real.
Okay. We're also sitting on the floor in your fucking fabulous apartment.
Thank you. And the reason that I can't sit cross-legged is because I shattered my ankle playing roller derby years ago. And
oh my God, I forgot about the roller derby. When did that happen?
Actually, it ties in with Book Soup.
Okay.
I'll tie it in. Perfect. I'll tell you.
Don't forget
that. I will not.
Okay.
So anyway, I would run these events, you know, be there from like 5 to 9 p.m. or so,
yeah.
Go home. And at a certain point, Tyson's assistant left the store, and I said, you know, if you need a new one, maybe I should do that.
Yeah.
And he said, I think that would be a really good idea.
Yeah.
And so... I ended up becoming his assistant, and I did that for 4 years.
So did that end up being your full time? Okay,
so that was full time, and then he left. So Vroman's bought Book Soup. Well, in January 2009, the owner of Book Soup, Glenn, died of pancreatic cancer.
Okay.
And we kind of have this, like, if you know anyone who ran that store, who was in that store in that year, because Vroman's bought it December 1. Yeah. Romans is another bookstore in Pasadena. They bought Book Soup on December 1, 2009. So we had to keep, our job was to keep this store open for 1 year with we had no capital. We had to just do it. Okay. We had to make payroll every month. We had to make the rent every month. And basically it was like this weirdo wild, wild west year where we all like, I mean, I was working, I think, this store doesn't exist anymore, so they can't get in trouble for this. Yeah. But I was working probably 80 hours a week and getting paid for 40.
Yeah.
And kind of all of us were doing stuff like that, just like killing ourselves to make this store just go, you know, and keep going. And, you know, it is an important store for the history of the Sunset Strip and for the history of Los Angeles. And so we just felt, I think all of us felt like this was something that we could do for the preservation of the store. Yeah. Yeah. And we loved it. I mean, listen, it was a great place to be. When Romans took over, you know, I was like, I'll give them a little bit of time. Tyson left at that point. He started Rare Bird, and it was at that point with PR company.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like,
So did you move into Tyson's position?
No. Someone else was in Tyson's position. I was the assistant promotional director. And I mean, it's just, the culture was just different. I mean, Vroman's is just a much more corporate entity than Book Soup was, mm-hmm. which is fine. And they obviously functioned very well. For my personality, that didn't work very well.
Yeah.
And so I sort of was a little bit, towards the end there, was a little bit miserable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I discovered roller derby.
You needed an outlet.
I needed an outlet. And I was like, I had managed to see a game at one point. It was when the book Whip It came out.
Yeah.
And I didn't know it at the time, but Whip It was written by Shauna Cross, who's a woman who, if you're an LA Derby doll, you'll know as Maggie Mayhem.
Okay.
And she wrote the book Whip It, which I absolutely adored. And if you haven't read it, you should. It's great.
I haven't read it, but I saw the movie, right?
Yes, you saw the movie. So Shauna also wrote the screenplay for Whip It. And it's a bunch of women from the LA Derby Dolls trained the women how to skate.
Yes.
So
you hadn't skated before that?
I had not skated. Well, yeah. I knew how to roller skate.
You knew how to roller skate.
But
in a circle going really fast.
Yeah. The controlling what was happening was a little iffy.
Yeah.
So, and I was like, you know, I need an outlet. I need something to do. I felt like, I thought I was like, it'll be an outlet for my aggression.
Yeah.
It was not. The thing about roller derby is that for 2 hours, you think like, oh, I'll get to hit people and it'll be so great. Here's the deal. For 2 hours, twice a week, that bitch is gonna try to fucking kill me.
Kill you, yeah. You try not to get killed. I think it's like maybe more anxiety inducing than you had without it.
But the thing is that like that's the only thing you're thinking about.
Oh, so it's like meditative.
It's kind of like meditation. And listen, as a person who like, I'm not gonna sit and meditate, but I'll go like have someone draw on me with ink and needles for 5 hours, which is like a kind of meditation for me. I like a little bit of pain with my meditation.
Yeah.
I think that's my real problem with meditation. It's not painful enough.
Yeah. Well, it's a different kind of painful. Because it's like, it's painful to sit there and do nothing.
Sure.
It is.
No, it is. It is.
So
it
bad.
Absolutely.
It's so bad that you would rather be beat or stuck with pins than sit there and do nothing.
Yes, that's true. But so derby just like gave me that.
Yeah.
You know, and then I got to be around all these amazing women and of all ilk, of all backgrounds, of all shapes and sizes, of all colors, of all identities, and just like see these fucking rad successful women in a way that I feel like, even though I come from a family of pretty rad ladies, this was like different somehow. I mean, I'll never like I said, I did shatter my leg into multiple pieces at
multiple
one point.
Times or only one time?
One time I shattered my leg. My shoulders will never be the same. My knees will never be the same. But I have a plate in my leg.
And you were a competitive swimmer.
I was a competitive. I did everything.
You did all the sports.
I was a competitive swimmer. I played softball, soccer, basketball, tennis, water polo, and I was a junior lifeguard.
Yeah. Okay.
So like I am a pretty athletic person.
Yeah.
And I like team sports a lot.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'm a big sports fan. I'm a San Francisco Giants baseball fan, yeah. Among other things, but that first and foremost. And so I love sports. And
how do you think sports informed your career? Your career choice and your career path, doing events, doing publicity?
That's interesting. I mean, baseball is poetry.
Okay.
I mean, it is.
I know. I have this conversation with Stacey from our office yes. all the goddamn time.
As do I. Yes. And Stacey and I are on the same page about it.
Yeah.
But baseball is poetry, and baseball is, it's so beautiful, and it's so, it's like pastoral, you know, they're in the middle of this bright green field, and it's in the summertime, and you have to deal with things like shade and wind and heat sometimes, and how that's going to make the ball move differently. And, you know, I mean, I'm from the Bay Area. If you're in AT&T or, oh God, they changed the name and I'm going to forget
Giants,
what it is.
Where the Giants are?
Yeah, it was AT&T Park until a few months ago, and now just like a terrible fan, I'm going to forget what they call it now. Some corporate entity park. But the wind blows in sometimes, and sometimes no matter how hard you hit that ball, it's not going to leave.
Okay.
You know, the wind is blowing it back into the field.
Yeah.
And there's something so beautiful about that.
Yeah.
There's something so beautiful about the fact that a baseball game, everyone gets the same amount of play time.
Yeah.
You get you get 27 out, or yeah, 27 outs. You get 27 people. No, you get 9 people on the field. You get, you know, the same. It's the same all the time.
Yeah.
Basketball, one team might have the ball for longer. And technically baseball, that's true too, but you each get the same amount of turns.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
If someone gets 3 extra turns, you also get 3 extra turns.
Okay.
At the bat.
Do you bring that kind of like, you know, that need for equality or equanimity to like your authors? Because you're kind of like it's like me with Emerging Voices. It's like I have all these unknown writers and I'm trying to get them, help them build a platform or get them FaceTime or kind of like help them matter in some way. Like,
that's interesting. Yeah. Okay. I mean, my job makes it so that I don't get to give everyone equal time.
Right. Okay.
To be quite frank about it. You know, there are certain books that we know are going to sell that because we're a for-profit publisher, I have to put time and energy and effort behind that book in a way that I don't necessarily get to with other books.
Right.
And I think like sometimes that wears on me.
Yeah.
Because I want to.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I mean, that's the reality of my job.
Yeah. Okay. So I sidetracked you.
No, it's okay.
So Tyson left, you're at Book Soup, it's kind of corporate.
Yeah.
What happens now?
So I want to preface this story because I don't look great in it by saying that I've worked for Tyson Cornell for quite some time.
Yeah.
And at that point had worked for him for a long time, and we had been through some real shit together.
Yeah.
And, he knows not to take me super seriously when I'm being an asshole.
Yeah.
So I saw him one day and I was like, he and I had sort of talked and he was like, I want to hire you when I can afford you. And I was like, oh, my extremely high bookseller salary is so hard to meet.
Right.
You know? And like, and so he's like, we were in a meet. We were like both on the board of like the West Hollywood Book Fair or something. One year, he was like, "Hey, come get a cup of coffee with me after this." And I was in just like the most awful mood, and I was like, "Well, make it quick."
Yeah, yeah.
Right. I was just like, I don't know.
Yeah,
I was at my wit's end.
Yeah,
and
as you are when you work 80 hours a week.
Yeah, and like, you know, I was in a spot that I needed to not be in anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And like, that's the reality of the situation. It was no one's fault, but I just shouldn't have been there.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, we were sitting down to coffee and he was like, I kind of was like, okay, I'm going to actually tell him that I need to leave this place.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, look, I know we've had these conversations. I said, but I think I need to leave now. I need to leave Book Soup. And, you know, it's wearing on me. I don't get to do the same things I used to do. And, you know, it's just like, there's a different culture I'm not vibing with it very well. And he was like, and so I was like, so if you know anyone, like, I'm going to start looking. And like, I know we said I would work for you. And like, I still will, but like, you know, I need something in the interim. Like, yeah. I'm not going to be able to hold out here until you're ready to pay me. I mean, I don't even want to say out loud what I was making at the time. Yeah, yeah. It was so low.
Right.
And yeah. He looked at me and sort of laughed. And I will say that I said that not as nicely as I just said it.
Yeah, yeah.
And he looked at me and laughed and he said, I need to hire someone. And I want to hire you. And I can afford you now. And I said, oh my God, seriously? And he said, yeah. He goes, listen, the thing is I can afford you for a month for this like big event that I'm putting together. And then I can't guarantee anything else. But you know, I will work as hard as I can to like make sure that I can and blah, blah, blah. And you know, I know Tyson very well. And I just, at that point, I was just like, just get me out of this.
Yeah.
So I don't feel stuck.
Yeah.
And fine, I'll take it. So I took it. I took that job that was only guaranteed for a month. And it's now been 9 and almost a half years
yeah.
that I've worked at Rare Bird.
Okay.
So yeah, when I first started at Rare Bird, we didn't have an office. Tyson had a loft downtown that we worked out of,
okay.
For the first like 2 months. And then we got a little office downtown and he and I just sort of, I mean, I thought 80 hours a week was hard. That those first few years of Rare Bird, there were multiple days in a row where I just didn't leave.
Yeah.
We had a couch. Sometimes I would come in at 7 a.m. and Tyson would be sleeping on it. Sometimes, you know, he had two young children at the time. They're older now, but sometimes he would leave to go home and put them to bed. And then when I was leaving at 11 p.m. or something, he would walk in the door to start doing stuff. And we kind of were this crazy duo. And then we were mostly doing PR at the time for other authors.
Okay.
And we were known in New York publishing as events people. So they would, you know, hire us to go out and help run events or help set up events in LA for bigger authors and stuff like that. And then, kind of slowly what happened was people would come to us with manuscripts and be like, this got rejected from 30 places. Can you tell me, like, is it just awful or, like, what's wrong? And we were kind of like, no, we don't know why this isn't being published. And you know, I kind of got ahead of myself, so I'll backtrack a little bit. And when we were, our last year at Book Soup, I wasn't involved, but, well, I kind of was. But, like, we used to, so we were working these 80-hour work weeks. And, you know, you fuck around to, like, you're at work all the time. You, like, have to have things that distract you from it.
Yeah.
And we would, like, make up books. Like, what's your book gonna be?
Yeah.
And the design guy would like design covers for people.
So yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so mine was called Perfect Frustration. Tyson's was like White Tail Hunter. It was like, you know,
yeah.
There was one called Courting the Jaguar. There was like a bunch of like, you know, everyone kind of had their own
yeah.
like different things. One guy, Joseph Mattson, who was the design guy, he was a writer and had an MFA and sort of was writing on the side. And he wrote this book and I forget why we ended up publishing. I remember. The band Six Organs of Admittance did a soundtrack to the book and no bigger publisher would take it with the soundtrack. And so he was like, well, I don't want to do it without the soundtrack.
Right.
And Drag City Records, who distributes Six Organs of Admittance, was like, well, we'll take a bunch of them if you do this. And so Tyson and Charles Day, who has worked at Penn, and Joseph started Barnacle Books and published Joseph's book. And you know, they sold out of that print run almost immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And then other people came to us. So this woman, Oriana Small, who is a porn star known as Ashley Blue, that's her porn name. We knew her because we had done some events with her husband. She was like, well, I wrote this memoir and I feel like a big publisher like offered her something for it, but they were going to change a bunch of stuff. And so she was like, would you do it? And we were like, would you trust us to do that? And that was kind of the first book that Rare Bird did. I mean, it's still, it's a Barnacle book, but Rare Bird really, like, I remember picking that manuscript up at 2 o'clock in the morning somewhere, like, on some, like, dark LA street.
Such a great LA story. Yeah. Porn star memoir.
Yeah.
Some back corner alley.
And up until literally like a year and a half ago, it was our best-selling novel. Or best-selling book. Yeah. It's we have one that recently sort of surpassed it. But it still sells tremendously well for us. Mm-hmm. It's a great book. It's called Girl Vert, a porno memoir. And that's sort of where we started. So we kind of had a few books published. So it wasn't insane that people were asking us about publishing. And basically in, I think, 2012, we got distributed by Publisher Group West. And that's where we really, like, kind of flipped over. They were like, we love the books you guys published, but you're going to need to publish a lot more.
Right.
And so we started, we doubled every year for 3 or 4 years.
So what's Publisher Group West?
So Publisher Group West is a distributor that distributes independent presses.
Okay.
But they're a wonderful distributor. And they have a sales team. You know, book selling is like might as well be in the 1800s. Okay. It's so bananas backwards, but like it works for us kind of. And so we keep doing it,
yeah.
But like there are traveling salespeople who cover a region who, meet face to face with the buyers at all of the big indie bookstores. There are people who meet face to face with the Barnes and Noble buyers, the Amazon buyers, you know, gift market buyers, things like that. So PGW has those folks. And so we pay a percentage of what we sell to PGW. And those folks go out and sell our books into the market.
Okay.
And do all sorts of things. It's, you know, it's funny. I said earlier, I always want authors to know how much publishers do. I always understand that the distributor is doing like 90,000 things more than I think they're doing. And so I always like try to like place myself within that. Like, okay, Julia, like even if something is maybe frustrating, like I'm like, you know that they're doing a million things that you're not even seeing.
Right.
So,
yeah.
So they're great. And they picked us up. So we doubled, we were doing about 6 books a year. Then we doubled to 12, then we doubled to 24, then 48, and that's where we're at about now.
Okay.
But it was every year.
Yeah.
And so it was like, there are these like 4 kind of lost years where I'm just like, I don't even know what happened.
Right. Because you basically didn't sleep.
We were just in like triage of like, let's, you know, get these books out and blah. And we learned a ton of stuff. And, you know, now we're kind of settled in a little bit more of like, okay, here's how this all works.
Yeah.
And here's how we put out a book effectively. And here's what, you know, here are the things that we tried and didn't work. And here are the things that we tried and did work. And so now we're much more, we do about 45 to 50 books a year.
Okay.
And that's how it's been for the last few years. And we're not looking at growing.
So if someone wanted Rare Bird to publish their book, they're querying you directly. Their agent would query you. How does it work?
The agent would query our editorial director, who's a guy named Guy Antosi. He like reads the manuscripts or part of it and sees if there's something that he thinks is there or whatever. And then also like I sort of will put in my marketing 2 cents. So at a certain point before we necessarily like acquire books, I sort of like say if I think there's marketability or saleability. So like I do have the ability to acquire books. Some I do get pitch books. I used to be able to acquire more, but like just timing wise, it's like anytime I acquire a book, I have to do all of the work for that book, not during work hours. Like I got it. So like that's my weekends and my nights. And not that, so I have to really love it.
Yeah. No, it's true.
And like, really be like, oh my God, I can't give this to another publisher.
Right. So what does your day look like? What does a typical day for Julia look like? Or a week? Because I know you're like kind of all over the place.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So there is no typical day necessarily. I mean, I get a lot of email, a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of my day, honestly, sometimes ends up just putting out whatever fire is in my email.
Mm-hmm.
I
give us a sample fire. tell us something that happened without, like, you don't have to say people's names. Or anything.
Well, yeah. So last week you know, Tuesday is when new books came out. We had a new book come out on Tuesday. The author was doing an event on Tuesday. I get an email Tuesday night at about 7. I'm like having dinner. I get an email that's like, the first 48 pages are missing from this book. You know, your heart stops.
Yeah. Like my face. I didn't make any noise, but my face was just like, oh my God, what
are you doing? What the fuck? So, you know, and when an author is freaked out, like, they sometimes don't give you the information that you need.
Yeah.
So, like, that's the email that I get is, like, you know, some of these books are missing the first 48 pages. Oh, my God, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
So, I'm like, well, I mean, legit, like I said, everything about events is, like, being able to not freak out. So, that's the same with my job is, like, okay, I'm not going to, like, there's nothing I can do about it at 7 p.m. on a Tuesday. Okay.
Right.
First of all, everyone that I need to talk to is on the East Coast. So it's 10 p.m. on a Tuesday for them.
Yeah. And those people are not working still.
They are not answering the phone. Yeah. So,
unlike
Miss Julia. And smart. And they're smart.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to learn from them. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, okay, do you have enough books? Not that I can do anything, but just like, are there enough books to sell to people that are there? Yes. Great. Go knock this event out of the park. I will be in touch tomorrow morning. So in the morning, then I have to go in and I'm like, okay, what's going on here? We check all our books. None of our books have this problem. The author has said none of his books have this problem. I have to then call all the bookstores because he's got more events this week.
Yeah.
And be like, hi guys, check your books. If you find this problem, tell me, we'll replace anything. Then I've got to email the distributor and say, hi guys, you might hear from some bookstores about this being a problem. Like, here's what's happening. Then I have to email the warehouse and say, can y'all check this stuff?
Right.
Make sure, pull whatever's wrong. Then I don't do this, but someone in my office has to email the printer and say, hey, we have this problem. And the printer's like, okay, you know, we're so sorry. Let us know how many damages there are and we'll credit you whatever we need to credit you.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, we have a very good working relationship with our printer. And, you know, it's, like, they're books. They're not, you know, I'm not, like, no one's on a surgery table. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
While this is an emergency that I need to, like, handle before, like, 300 books with the first 48 pages missing go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or something like that. Like, I gotta figure that out. And we have to make sure that they're warned so that, like, they know that this might be an issue and they should check their books before they send them.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that kind of fire.
Right.
So, you know, it's like, it's not the end of the world, but it also, I gotta deal with that.
Right. So how do you figure out how, because you're dealing with like so many different writers and so many different pieces of this puzzle.
Yeah.
How do you figure out how to put limits on your time and like how to have like, quote unquote, office hours?
I have very strict boundaries that I make abundantly clear. So, like, I do not like being text messaged unless it's an emergency.
Okay.
And, it, like, sometimes I think people think I'm a bitch about it. My thing is, like, I'm going to forget.
Yeah. Right.
It's got to be in my email.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'm literally going to forget.
Yeah.
I don't like being called on my cell phone unless it's an emergency.
Right.
If you're having an emergency, like, if legitimately, like, you know, you're at a place and there's no books or like this is the thing is that it's books. There's not that many real, like,
right.
I have to deal with this right fucking now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But like, oh, I'm at an interview that you set up and no one's here. Like, that's an emergency. Call me on the phone. We'll figure out what the problem is.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
You know, but like, I don't know about this subtitle is not something that I can't deal with tomorrow.
Right.
You know, so like I do have very strict boundaries. I try not to work at home. Like, I don't come home and get back on my computer. I might read.
Mm-hmm.
I do read. I really read a lot of what my work reading at home.
Mm-hmm.
But I make sure to have like to carve out a little bit of time for myself.
Good.
So I do. I mean, you know, my job. You know, I get to work anywhere between 8 and 10 in the morning, depending on the day. And then I leave anywhere between 6 and sometimes if I have to go to an event, 10 or 11 p.m. So, as you know, I travel. I do almost all of the, or not almost all of it, but I do a significant portion of the travel.
Yeah.
For my company. So sometimes, you know, I work all week. On Friday, I get on a plane to go to Austin or something like that. And I'm at a book fair all weekend, like, dealing with my authors there and, like, networking and meeting people. And then on Sunday night or Monday morning, I get on a plane and I go straight back to the office,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
and work all the next week. And so it, that's where it can get, like, a little bit hard,
yeah.
like, the travel aspect,
right.
where, you know, on April 1st, I have to fly to Portland in the morning, go be with two authors at a signing in the afternoon for a bunch of booksellers, and then I fly directly back that night.
Yeah.
That's fine. I'm happy to do that. But, like, on Tuesday, then, I'm exhausted, and I'm exhausted for the rest of the week.
Right,
and
right.
so, like, there is a part of me that's like, okay, so on Tuesday, I leave at a certain time. You know, I go to therapy
yeah.
To deal with all of this. And then I go to the gym.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's my thing. And, like, I'm not going to, it's got to be really important for me to move something.
Right, right.
You know.
We have to figure out ways to make regular work weeks out of a very irregular work week.
Exactly.
Yeah.
People are like, oh my God, but you get to go to all these book fairs. And I'm like, listen, I am 100% lucky and happy to be there. You know, you and I get to see each other in New York
yeah.
sometimes, or, like, in, you know, wherever, in Portland, get to hang out with folks. That's awesome.
Yeah.
And, like, I would not trade that for anything.
Yeah.
But, like, I've been trying to be realistic about the fact that, like, it's also exhausting.
Yeah. Because you're on all the time. I don't think people understand. I think that writers need to understand that, too. And this, I loved you said this at that panel in AWP where it was like, yeah, we ask all these, like, introverts who are used to sitting in a room by themselves to suddenly, like, come out and be, like, the life of the party
right.
and talk to everyone.
Right.
And it is so true.
It's so true. But then at the same time, like, you know, I mean, I did events. I did nothing but events for years and years. I've probably done about 2,500 events in my life.
Yeah.
I've seen so many awful events. I understand that it's bananas that we ask authors to do this.
Yeah.
But also remember, you're the entertainment.
Yeah. I personally love that because, as you well know, that's kind of my jam.
Yeah.
But, like, what other advice do you have for authors that have books coming out or going on tour?
Viet Nguyen did a great, like, a couple of days ago, maybe on Thursday or Friday, did, like, a great, like, Twitter thread about, like, realizing that he's the entertainment. Because he was kind of like, I know this is blasphemy, but, like, I used to hate going to, I kind
readings
of hate going to literary
yeah.
readings.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, yeah, bro, a lot of us do.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, you know me, I can't, if you ever see me at an event, I'm usually in the back pacing. I can't sit.
Mm-hmm.
I hate sitting at events because I, like, need to not, like, I just, I've done so many of them that it always feels like work no matter where I am.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do need to, like, pace around. Also, sometimes I'm like, I just don't want to watch you read.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, like, I know that's very honest, but
yeah.
I kind of just don't want to watch you read. The thing is that, like, if you're like, I'm not confident in my reading, that's fine. Get someone to do a Q&A with you.
Right.
I always feel like, and then also remember that, like, and this is something that Viet said in his, like, Twitter thread, I'm a little bit acting when I'm on that stage.
Yeah.
And I was like, bro, yes.
Yeah.
Like, I had an author recently that I was at his event. I'm not going to say a name because I'm going to say something not super nice. But, like, he was answering these questions very honestly, which I, like, kind of, like, okay, great, bro, you do you. It made it a little bit boring.
Yeah.
And I was like, just, like, give it some flair.
Yeah.
Like, people don't need to hear. People are there to be entertained. If you lie a little bit, you're not Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos, like, telling everyone that your machine works when it really doesn't.
Right, right, right.
You're just entertaining them.
Right.
You just want them to. And I mean, like, let's be honest about what the book business is. You want them to buy your goddamn book.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, you gotta sell that thing.
Yeah.
It's not easy to sell books.
Yeah.
Working with sometimes bigger celebrities, like, they will, like, look at you. I had a meeting with a guy who's in a pretty big band, and he wrote a book, and he was like, yeah, no one tells you how hard it is to sell a book.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this guy has millions of fans around the world.
Yeah.
Millions.
Yeah.
And he's like, it's so hard
yeah.
to sell books.
Yeah.
And so, like, imagine this guy who's in I mean, legit name the five biggest rock bands of all time. I guarantee you this is one of them. And it's a private conversation. It was a private conversation, which is why I'm not saying his name. Yeah. He was legitimately like, it's super hard. Yeah. Like, it's so hard. And his book sold very well. He was a New York Times bestseller. Yeah. But even that, it's like the numbers to get on the New York Times bestseller list are shockingly low. I mean, they're high for the book business, but they're shockingly low for like, it, like when film producers make, like do books, they're always like, what?
Yeah, right, yeah, right.
You know, and when they like, when I remember having a conversation with this guy who, he was like a VP at Fox. I think he was the guy who like greenlit the Tyler Perry movies. Uh-huh. He, I forget his name. He was this really cool like VP. And then he was also like a minister. Or I'm just gonna show my absolute ignorance of all religion.
Okay.
I don't know what his exact title was.
He's like a higher up in some religious.
It was a Protestant church of some kind.
Okay, that's good.
I'm like, I was raised like Catholic adjacent, right? Like I had the hippie shitty parents who were like, "Fuck that shit, we're not doing
but also
that."
Italian.
Italian and Irish, yeah. So I've got all the guilt. But I apologize for my absolute ignorance of this. So he wrote this great book. It was like a spiritual book, but it was also kind of like about succeeding in an industry that like, he was a black guy and he succeeding in an industry that like doesn't really like cater to you, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so he was great. And he was like asking me all about like, well, what should I expect? And we were having this conversation. What I realized is that like, he was thinking that books and movies were very similar.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, I was like, you might not sell that many on the first week, but this can build and like, it's fine. Like movies are like, if you don't do well in the first week, everyone forgets about the movie. Like you're done. Bye. See you later. Books are different. There are so many books that like, you know, are household names that were not instantaneous bestsellers that sort of grew and grew and grew and grew, mostly because booksellers are nerds and figure and read them and they hand them to each other. And, you know, Chris Krause's I Love Dick, you know, was a show on Amazon, but that book came out years ago and people just hand it to each other.
Right. I think that's like, that leads us into the next thing is this idea of personal relationships and why they're so important. And why do you think the LA literary community is so tight and so successful?
Yeah.
And, you know, talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. I mean, obviously with any industry, personal relationships are important.
Right.
Sure, networking's important. With this industry, it's so hard to, there's so many books that come out every year. It's so hard to get anyone to pay attention to anything. I can only speak from my personal experience on personal relationships. I like to know people who, like, I know your taste. So, like, booksellers at a bookstore, like, I know your taste. So, like, I'm only going to send you books that I actually think that you would really, really like.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where, like, having those personal connections with interviewers, with reviewers, with you and I even, like, you know, having those connections where I'm like, you know, you can call me and I'm, unless I'm out of town, I'm probably going to say yes to you.
Yes, this is a true story.
This is a true.
Yeah.
And I know I can call you if I need you and be like, can you put, you know, can you help me with this? Or can you, you know, is there someone there that knows how to do this thing or that thing or whatever? Or do you have like a name of an editor that I can possibly use? Like you, I can also do that to you. That's reciprocal. And we didn't found our friendship on that.
Yeah.
But the fact that we have a friendship means that we can do that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, for me, that's important. I mean, the cool thing about the book business, right, is we're all these fucking nerds who like to read.
Yeah.
So, like, there's always something to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
There's always a book to talk about or, like, you know, oh, my God, have you, did you get this galley? You know, like,
yeah.
I'm very good friends with Olivia Taylor Smith from Unnamed Press.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I got a galley that she really wanted at Winter Institute. And it's, like, I was kind of holding it over her head for a second. But, you know, I'll give it to her. I'm done with it now and I'll give it to her. But, like, you know, we have friendly relationships like that, too. And Olivia and I, like, we're distributed by the same distributor. So, like, sometimes we're, like, do you know how to work this thing or use this thing? Or, like, I'll go have lunch with her and Chris and they'll pick my brain about some marketing thing. Or I'll be like, you guys are so good at doing literary fiction. Like, what, if you had a book like this, like, who would you reach out to? Like, and she's like, oh, let me give you that person's email. Like, it's no, there's no ego. We're not in competition with each other. That's the cool thing. And that's, and I think in Los Angeles particularly, we're really not in competition with each other. We are all in this together, kind of, you know, like, it's small. I mean, I hesitate to speak about the New York publishing scene because I have never lived in New York and I am not really a part of it. All I know is that I'm always underdressed at their parties.
Right.
For me, like, the fact that, like, I can go show up at an event at Skylight and I'm probably going to know someone, that's awesome.
It's the best.
And not just that I'm probably going to know someone, like, I'm probably going to see someone that I'm like, I'm really happy to see you.
Right.
And, so Skylight Books is my local bookstore. We're sitting about 5 blocks from it right now.
Right.
Kelsey and David, who run the events there, I have to work with, but also we're friends, you know, like, we'll go have wine or go to drinks or something like that. When I get to see them, like, when I'm at Winter Institute, which is like a big, like, booksellers convention, and I get to see them, like, it's so nice having that here in Los Angeles where, you know, I don't have to, first of all, I don't have to deal with snow, which, like, just, I know that's so, like, a Los Angeles thing to say, but good God.
Yeah.
I don't have to deal with snow. I don't have to deal with humid summers. I mean, it gets hot here and it's hot in this apartment, but, like, I don't have to deal with all of that stuff. And then also, like, as much as I love New York, like, I don't have to, like, pay rent in New York.
Right.
Which, like, is really just, like,
yeah,
a major plus.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
I just like, you know, and going back to your question at the beginning about what you like about Los Angeles, I mean, that's one of the things, is that Los Angeles truly still has such a creative output.
Right.
As a city. Like, there's so many super talented, creative people here. Like, go to karaoke at a bar in, like, Silver Lake, and shit, man. I mean, people are so fucking talented.
Right.
You know, I mean, like, it sometimes makes it not as fun to do karaoke.
Right,
but, like, at the same time, like, you know, there's always something cool going on. There's always something. And I think within the literary community, that's true too, right? Like, there's always something great going on. LA is such a literary city too, like, in this, like, low-key way that, like, people are always like, oh, Joan Didion and, you know, Nathaniel West. But I'm like, yeah, but there's so many other great LA books.
Yeah.
And, like, LA itself is kind of a crazy, meandering, weird novel.
Totally. Give me, who are your favorite LA writers? Well, no, that's not fair, because there's too many.
There's a lot.
But, like, tell me a couple, like, quintessential LA novels or short story collections, whatever.
Yeah, so, I mean, Wanda Coleman, always.
Yeah.
Fuck, man. She's so good. All of her stuff.
Yeah.
I just read The Mars Room by Rachel Kushner,
okay,
which has, it's not a it's not an act, it's a California novel,
because
it's also a little bit in San Francisco, and I will admit that it made me feel a nostalgia for, like, 90s gritty shithole San Francisco that, like, will never go away.
Mm-hmm.
I love Better by John O'Brien. So John O'Brien wrote Leaving Las Vegas before he, ooh, I'm going to get it wrong. I can't remember if he killed himself or if he drank himself to death as well.
Okay.
He might have been doing a bit of both.
I was just going to say a bit of both.
Yeah. But Better came out after he died, and it is such a fucking great Los Angeles novel.
Oh, I want to read it.
Yeah. Great. I mean, even Bret Easton Ellis, which, like, whatever you feel about him, like, Less Than Zero is a fucking great LA novel.
It is amazing. It is. Also, I hesitate to say this myself, but Bright Shiny Morning, James
Bright
Frey.
Shiny Morning, James Frey.
I love that book.
Yeah. I did the event for that book at BookSoup. I did the, like, launch event, yeah.
I love that book.
Yeah.
Because I felt like when I moved here, because I'm Canadian, when I moved here, you know, like, I lived in Downey.
I
lived in Bell Gardens. Like,
yeah.
I lived in Huntington Beach. Like, I never really lived in L.A.
In
proper.
In L.A., yeah.
So it was, like, so cool to see this, like, these stories that were telling me, like, how L.A. is L.A. and where the freeways came from and why we're so spread out. I learned so much from that book.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I gotta say, like, when I was 16, a friend of mine, I was, like, a junior in high school, and a friend of mine put the Wheatsy Bat book, Francesca Leah Block's Wheatsy Bat, in my hand. And I was like, this is a kid's book. Why would I read that? And she was like, girl, read it. And I devoured the whole series. And that's the first not book that made me realize that, like, L.A. actually might be cool.
Yeah.
It was like, I was like, oh, L.A. might be kind of rad.
Yeah.
And it was queer, and it was like, you know, it was like, it took place at Okie Dog, which, like, the first time I saw Okie Dog on Fairfax, I almost fucking crashed my car.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was like the first time I saw Circus Liquors from Clueless.
Oh my God.
Which is my, as I told you, is my favorite movie of all time. It's a perfect, perfect adaptation of Emma.
Yeah.
Not to be a nerd about it.
Yeah.
It's also just a perfect movie, but what a great adaptation. Yeah. I legit almost crashed my car when I saw Circus Liquors for the first time. And Okie Dog. I feel like... okay, so I'm going to say something insane, which is that I was just watching Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and there's, like, this episode where they were teaching the captain about Sex and the City, and they're like, the fifth character is New York, you know? And I'm like, L.A. is almost always the character in the novel about L.A., and also never.
Yeah.
New York is, like, loud whenever it's in the middle of a... whenever something's set in New York is loud.
Yeah.
You know it's in New York. L.A. is kind of like... it can be a little bit quiet.
Yeah.
Because you're just on streets. And you're, like, on streets that mostly have single-family houses.
Yeah.
And you're, like, in this kind of, like, bright palm tree-lined abyss that never, ever ends.
Yeah.
And it's so beautiful. And then at the same time, it's, like, so plain.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
Like, and I also feel like there's no, like, this idea of, like, breaking the fourth wall. Like, there's no fourth wall in Los Angeles. Like, it just feels like you're always a part of something, even when you're just living your normal life and nothing's happening.
Right.
You're, like, in the middle of something going on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very bizarre.
It's a very bizarre place to be. Yeah. And, like, working downtown, so Rare Bird's offices are downtown. Working for downtown, in downtown for now almost 10 years, like, what's so weird about Los Angeles is, like, I always joke, every single car commercial passes my office.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like at my parents' house in Santa Cruz. And like my dad, when I was a kid, always used to know where everything was in movies. And like, I kind of like, I realized like he lived in LA. He grew up on La Cienega and the 10 freeway, basically.
Okay.
You know, he would always be like, oh, that's on this street or that's this place or whatever. And then like, now he's pretty terrible at it, and I'm like, that's my office, there's my office, there's my office, every time.
Right.
You know, and so there's that kind of weird thing, too. There's, like, at least once every couple of months, I walk out of my office building, and there's just New York City taxi cabs on the street, right, because they're filming something,
right,
you know?
Yeah, so you're, like, always in the movie.
You're always, like, in the middle of it. The other day, so I like, walk and read my book at the same time. I take the train to work. So when I leave,
there's a train here.
Yeah. Shh, don't tell anyone.
Yeah.
So, I take the train to work. When I get out of my, subway stop to go to my office, I walk about 3 blocks. And a lot of times if I'm reading, I will like keep reading until I get to my office. And, this one morning I like had my face in a book and I looked up and like Ryan Phillippe was legitimately right in front of me filming something. Like I'd walked into this shot, not even paying attention. Ryan Phillippe was just standing in front of me and I just like, I was like, what just happened?
What happened? Yeah.
And then I just like kept walking. I was like, all right, well, I guess he's there. And that's right. What's happening outside today.
Yeah.
You know, one time I looked up and a San Francisco Muni bus was in front of me. And I like, as someone who grew up near San Francisco, I just like had this moment of like, what?
Did I just time?
Where am I? Yeah, like, what's it?
Totally.
What's going on? So there's like the filming part of it, which is like for me now, I mean, I used to be in it, but now it's sort of on the periphery. But then there's also like you know, walk down a street and there's like these huge murals or there's like, you know, when you leave the back of the Regent Theater, you end up in this like alley that's like Native Americans have like taken over and like done this amazing art, like these murals on the walls and talking about like colonialism and, you know, genocide and all those things. And you're just like, you're kind of confronted with these things at all times. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, that's the other thing about Los Angeles. It is one of the most diverse cities. And so you're constantly like in with other cultures.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you were asking about my neighbors earlier. Most of my neighbors don't speak English as a first language. you know, I smell these great, like, Filipino foods and Mexican foods and Salvadorian foods being cooked every night. Mm. I mean, like, what an amazing...
The Armenian kids.
They were, if you heard any children, it's an Armenian school, which I live next to.
Yeah.
And, you know... Yeah, it's like, I learned so much about the Armenian genocide living in this building for 10 years that I had no idea.
Right.
No idea.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's that too, where it's like, having to, and I don't mean having to, like, as it isn't a chore, it's a pleasure, but, like, being amongst people who came from elsewhere, but then also people who, you know, I mean, this is California, the border crossed a lot of people at some point.
Yeah.
You know, and then for me also, like, being from an immigrant family and how do I fit into this culture of immigrants?
Yeah.
You know, for me in Los Angeles, that's just such a beauty of it. I get to see all of this. You get to kind of see the melting pot as it happens.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You get to see it all melt together and mesh together. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but it's like this kind of beautiful chaos.
Yeah. I think for kids like us who, like, grew up in the pages of books, and it's like everything's a story.
Yeah.
It's like LA is that place come to life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I always want to know, like, people's story. It's like there used to be a couple next door a Filipino couple who, like, they're somewhere else in the building now. I don't know where, but, like, you know, they were gone for like 6 weeks and, like, I was, like, so concerned because I was, you know, all this stuff with immigration. And I was like, did they get stuck? I knew they were going home in the Philippines. And I was like, did they get stuck? And then, like, I popped up in a different, like, unit in the building. And we're like, we brought our kid, like, one of their kids from the Philippines, like, came, you know, their grandparents. And like, so I think one of their kids had been in the Philippines and then moved back. And I was just like, oh my God, like, just this, like, getting to hear those stories and getting to see firsthand people making their lives here. Like, that's such an honor and a pleasure that, like, I feel like, not to disparage my hometown, but Santa Cruz has a little of that, but, like, it's so white.
Yeah.
It's so, like, it fancies itself diverse, but it's not that diverse. And it's like, you don't get those stories.
Yeah.
You get other stories, which are fascinating and good.
Right.
And when I was younger, I used to think that maybe I should write something about it, but I think someone else definitely should.
Yeah. So we've been talking for like over an hour and we haven't talked at all about emerging voices.
Okay.
So let's just like touch on that.
Yes, please.
And I would love to. Like, I'm not cutting this down, everyone, just so you know, you're going to get like an hour and 25 minutes of Julia and I. But, when did you start? You've been doing an author evening. You, have done it with Chris Heiser from Unnamed Press for a while. I think since at least I was a fellow in 2012. How did that start happening?
Libby, well, so Michelle Frankie and I are good friends, and we go back to the Book Soup Days.
Book Soup Days. Michelle Frankie's our executive director here in Los Angeles.
And she is a one woman that I will do anything she asks me to, pretty much within reason. Don't ask too much, Michelle, come on.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. But she's like, she's the best, and I really will do, you know, if she ever asks me for anything, I'm always like, let's do this.
Yeah,
I'm in. She introduced me to Libby, and Libby was sort of running the Emerging Voices at the time. This is Libby Flores, who is a wonderful writer who's now in New York. And Libby was like, will you come do this small press night? And I said, of course, sure, no problem. And Chris and I have known each other for quite a while since this Unnamed started. And so I just had such a good time. And, like, you know, one of my things is, like, I definitely understand that, like, I come from a privileged background, you know, and so being able to sort of, like, use my expertise, like, you know, it's like when you're like, oh, I work in books, like, what, I'm not, like, you know, I'm not an ACLU lawyer trying to, like, like, do something great. So, like, anytime I can talk to people and, like, give whatever expertise I have, I like that. You know, and I'm happy to do that. And so, you know, I think Libby sort of told me what it was, what Emerging Voices was. And I was like, oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I'll definitely do that. And at the end of the day, it's like, it's an hour, two hours of my time.
Two hours, you get cheese. There's wine.
I get cheese.
Actually, when Julia comes, there's sometimes whiskey.
Yeah, people at Penn know what I like.
So what, talk about, like, what do you, why is Emerging Voices important, do you think?
Well, first of all, god damn, is the quality that comes out of that program is so insanely good. I honestly don't know how you guys do it. I mean, I would interview you for a whole podcast about how the hell you pick and like how you do that. The people are so good. And, you know, for me, I think the book industry is miles and miles behind where it should be about bringing in diverse voices and all kinds of diverse voices, you know? And so like for me growing up, I didn't get to read a lot of queer fiction. I didn't get to read a lot of, you know, I wasn't, when I was in high school, I was reading a lot of old white people. I mean, like, listen, part of it is my fault too. I have a degree in Victorian English literature. Yeah. I mean, like, wasn't exactly. I was like, a female. Yeah. Ooh, how exotic. You know, but like, it's like, for me, it's like I, as someone who's worked in the publishing industry a long time, I can see where the gaping holes are.
Yeah.
And you guys do a great job of picking people to fill those holes in interesting ways and people who are so extremely talented. And I'm always happy to, you know, any part of my knowledge that they could possibly use, I'm like, please take it and run. Like, yeah. I love it. I'm, you know, it's like I think about like Natalie Lima, who
2016.
Yeah, 2016. She wrote this essay about like, or this story about like being a plus size. I call myself fat, but like a plus
she
size
does
woman.
Story too. I think
yeah.
That's the title.
Yeah. Exactly. But like, fuck, man. Like, you. I never saw that ever growing up.
Yeah.
You know, that was never depicted anywhere. Right. You know, if someone was fat, they were ridiculed immediately. And so for me, like, seeing women be able to express themselves in that way, seeing men be able to express themselves in that way, and, like, knowing that you guys have this, like, pool of talent that, like I said, is diverse in ways that aren't just, you know, like...
Yeah. What does diversity mean to you? Like,
it's everything that's not, like, being shown, right? Yeah. It's everything that's, like, otherized.
Right.
So, like... Sometimes that means, you know, a poor black kid from South Central coming in and having these great stories. I read this one with Community Literature Initiative that is another great organization that I volunteer, or I do a night at and a few other things with them. But they, like, this one woman wrote this story about these gardens in Compton, and I just had this moment of, like, I've never heard of this.
Mm-hmm.
I've lived in LA for how many years? And this is like something that is entirely new to me.
Right.
And like, holy shit. And that's, and I mean, going back to our LA conversation, that's the thing about LA is always, there's always something new, like sort of exposing itself to you,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so for me, like, that's awesome. And that's, her story was amazing. Also, having someone who's fat talk about like being that.
Yeah.
Having someone who's queer talk about what that's like. Having someone who's homeless or has been homeless talk about what that was like. Those are things that to me, like, I don't see those things, you know, and I read a lot of what New York publishing is putting out. I run like multiple book clubs, which usually is, I mean, I try to slip small presses in, but
yeah.
A lot of times it means we have to read bigger
just
because it's more like, I don't know, sometimes it's more accessible to people. And so I see that they're not putting out things like this. I mean, they're starting to get better.
Yeah.
But they're like having people who train with you guys and then go on to get their MFAs and have this network that they started building before they were in the sort of pipeline to publish something. That's just like, it's incredible.
Tell us about you're doing the feminist book club downtown, Last Bookstore?
The Last Bookstore.
Is that still happening?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, so what's the next book on the block?
We're reading right now Dead Girls by Alice Boleyn.
Okay.
Which, as you see, is on my...
I see it.
My table with a bunch of Post-its sticking out of it.
I love it.
And then next month we'll read Educated by Tara Westover.
Amazing. Amazing.
And then after that, we're going to read Long Live the Tribe of
Fatherless Girls.
Yeah.
You're looking up.
So I'm looking at, yeah, I have a stack.
I'm definitely going to try to borrow some books off Julia before we leave. But I think leave us. So you already talked about, you know, things that you can do to make your reading more interesting and like going out on tour. Let's talk about like maybe being like a literary, like an upstanding. I don't want to use the word citizen because it has connotations of people that aren't citizens.
Sure.
But like being an active member of your literary community, like what are a couple things that you think are like vital?
Yeah. I mean, supporting people, supporting, you know, the people that are in it as well. So
what does that mean? Supporting?
You know, I go like, you know, I mean, I'm lucky that one of my best friends in this city and in the literary community happens to run like one of the best publishing houses. Mm. So I go to a lot of unnamed press events, you know, Prospect Park or Red Hen Press, like those peeps that are doing stuff here in Los Angeles. I try to go to a lot of their events. Anytime a Penn member or a Penn EV graduate has an event, I try to go. I can't always, but I do try to go, and I always buy and read their books. I have a real strict buying policy on books because Amanda can attest to this. I'm surrounded. It's, you know, it's kind of a problem. And I just got rid of 200 books, and this still looks like this in here. So Lillian Rivera just came out with a new book. I already bought it at Skylight. It's waiting for me to pick up.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like when Natasha Dionne's book Grace came out, immediately purchased that and read it and like loved it.
Yeah.
So my thing is like try to pay money, and I buy them in hardcover. I'm lucky enough that I am able to do that, to buy them in hardcover. I try to pay money to the ones that I want to see more of.
Yeah.
So, you know, no offense to Jonathan Franzen, but when he buys a book, when he writes a book, I'll check it out at the library.
Yeah.
But like, you know, when Lillian writes a book, like I want her to be able to keep writing, and I'm happy to pay for her book, and I'll buy it for other people if I, you know, have people that I think will love it, which I'm sure I do. You know, it's those kinds of things.
I think that putting your ass in the chair, like being at an event, because it doesn't cost you anything.
Yes.
Because like, I know like I'm on a limited budget, and in my position, I would just be buying books all the time, and it's not
possible.
Sure. I'm like, okay, well, we need that. Every time an EV comes out with a book, of course, we get that for the EV library. We try to get them to sign it. Rocio Carlos just came out with a new collection.
Yeah.
But whenever possible, it's like, I'm going to go to your event, and I'm going to sit in the chair, and I'm going to ask a question. I'm going to share it on social media, and I'm going to try to get other people to come. So I think that's a really good thing that people can do, is just show up. It's FaceTime.
And like when I see, you know, like I'm on Twitter, and I, you know, follow a lot of book people on Twitter. And when they tweet about someone's book that I am like super excited about, you know, like I'm just using Lilliam's as an example because it literally just came out.
Yeah. Like last week.
But like right now when I see Lilliam's book, you know, it's like, I always retweet it and I'm like, go buy this. You know, like my thing is like, I'm not some, I have like maybe 1,000 followers. I'm not some like influencer or anything, but at the same time, my thing is like, and nor do I aspire to be, but my thing is like, you know, I want her to feel supported. And also if one or two people are like, oh yeah, I've heard of this, and like see it in the bookstore and go like buy it for themselves and enjoy it and love it as much as I love all of her writing, like what a fucking success, man.
Yeah.
And like how great that we get to help our friends do this kind of thing, or help people that like, we're just like, I just want to fucking see more of your stuff in the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, it's much like television or film, like it's a business. And if you are able to sell those books, you get to keep going.
Yeah.
You know, so like I get the business side of that. So, you know, if I'm able to buy the books, great. Or if I'm able to convince someone else to buy the books, great. Also, the thing that's so fucking weird about books is it's also not just a business, you know.
Yeah.
It's also art, and art doesn't always make money. Publishers kind of know that and kind of, you know, have to ignore that. And so I think it's like, it's hard because showing up to an event is so great, and like that number gets reported back to the publishing house. Like the booksellers who run the event email the publishing house and say this many people showed up.
I did not know that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So even if you can't buy the book, just showing up at someone's event helps them immensely.
Yeah.
But also then just, like, being aware of, like, the literature of your city, or being aware of, like, what's going on in your city, or what the dearth is in your city, you know? Like, I mean, I was lucky to grow up in a place that's pretty literary friendly. I mean, there's a university there, so... But I know a lot of people have kind of, like, there's these, like, kind of book deserts, if you will.
Yeah. No, yeah.
You know, in certain areas, and it's like, okay, well, how do you help that? Is there something, you know, do you start a book club? Right. Do you start a, you know, whatever?
Like Maritza with Macara Center for the Arts in Santa Ana.
Yeah, there exactly.
Book, there was a book desert there, and she filled the need, created a nonprofit.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
EV 2008, I believe.
See, I mean, you guys are doing good shit everywhere. But, like, but, you know, those are the things where it's like, okay, you know, and not even that, but, like, so, you know, shopping at Esawam Books in in Limerick Park in Los Angeles, you know, it's a Black-owned bookstore. He's got such great stuff. It's such a great bookstore and such a great cultural touchstone in that neighborhood. Like, if I'm by there, I always, like, stick my head in and go buy something, you know? Like,
I love that, supporting your local bookseller.
And I mean, like, Skylight, you know, Skylight has my heart and soul, and they're my place. But also, like, I'll tell a funny little story, which is at Bookshop Santa Cruz, when I'll age myself right now.
Please do.
Which is that I lived through the earthquake in 89, which people think of as the San Francisco earthquake. It was epicentered in Santa Cruz, and the entirety of downtown Santa Cruz fell down.
Okay.
Including Bookshop Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
And then while they were rebuilding Pacific Avenue, all of the businesses were a block over in these big tents. So I actually grew up going to a place called Book Tent Santa Cruz.
Okay.
And so, you know, but, like, that place has very special meaning to me. And when I was in high school, I used to hang out there all the time. It was rebuilt by the time I was in high school. But, like, those places that, like, you've maybe heard about, or that, like, when you're in a small town or, like, hanging out, that you're like, okay, go in there. And even if you can't buy anything, just being in there and, like, seeing their stuff, or maybe taking an Instagram photo and, like, yeah, you know, telling your friends about it or something like that. Like, those are always good things, you know?
And, like, what a fun way to see your city also is, like, yeah, where are the bookstores? Yeah. Let's take a Saturday and, like, go to all the bookstores.
Yeah.
Like, and maybe even not Skylight, because they're all the
yeah,
time.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, go to all the ones you don't go
yeah,
to.
Yeah,
I love that. That's a perfect way to end.
Dude. And just my bucket list, Seattle on Indie Bookstore Day does Seattle, like, a special thing in Seattle where if you go to, I think it's, like, 19 bookstores, if you go to all of them and you get a stamp at each one, you, like, get, like, a special, like, discount at all of them for the year or something like that.
What?
But it's like my bucket list item. I, like, yeah, definitely want to do it at some point. You have to take at least one ferry because it's Seattle.
Yeah.
I just am like,
so
what
fun.
A great, great. They do such cool shit up there, man.
Yeah.
So, you know, it doesn't have to be LA.
Yeah.
You know, it can be anywhere.
Exactly.
You're
that's
whatever,
what I'm saying.
Wherever
you
are. Yeah, exactly.
Wherever you are.
Wherever you are. There's something, and if there isn't something, start a little book club, you know, just even if it's you and two other people just talking about some books and, you know, that's what it's, I mean, that's why we're all here.
Yeah.
To be almost famous about it, some stupid little, you know.
Me and Julia like almost famous.
We do. Faruza Balk says some stupid little piece of music affects you so much. And for me, it's music, but it's also some stupid little book, you know, just like opened your heart and mind to something.
Yeah.
And that's what we're here for.
Yeah.
Yeah, at the end of the day.
Thanks, Julie Callahan.
Thanks, Amanda Fletcher.
Where can we see you? You're going to have a booth at Festival of Books, which is in April.
Yeah, we're sharing a booth with Ziziva.
Okay.
At Festival of Books.
It's LA Times Festival of Books, and it's on the USC campus.
Yeah, I'll be at Wordplay in Minneapolis in May.
Okay.
Which is a great new, this is the first year, so we're going to be there. I'll be at Brooklyn Book Fest in September. I'll be at ALA in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
I'll be at Portland Book Festival in Portland in November.
So you're going to be, like, all over the country as you.
I'm always all over the country. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So if you're at any of those events or stop into the Rarebird website and take a gander at what they got going on and the books they're selling.
Yeah, exactly. And I am very easy to find on social media at Pesty1079 on all of them.
Pesty1079 on all of them.
Yes.
All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening.
Thanks, you.
Julia.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
PEN America champions the freedom to write and believes that freedom of expression and literature are inseparable. Visit PEN.org to learn more about what we do. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Join us. Be a part of the larger conversation. Support for EV comes from sources both big and small. Serious financial support comes from organizations like the Amazon Literary Partnership, California Arts Council, New Balloon and Catapult, Los Angeles County Arts Commission, the Ovation Foundation, Pasadena Literary Alliance, the Rosenthal Family Foundation, and UCLA Extension Writers Program. And let's not forget individuals like Jamie and David Wolf. We appreciate you. To the emerging voices themselves, this podcast is in support of everything you do and everything you've accomplished. Congratulations. We celebrate you. Thanks to 2012 EV Johnny Alfie for giving us our theme song, Linen, from his band, Tony and Johnny. And to the members of the Los Angeles literary community who have been showing up for us for more than 20 years, donating their time as mentors, committee members, author evening hosts, and masterclass instructors, I have leaned on each and every one of you for advice, and I appreciate you. You've been there to answer my questions, those of the fellows, as well as the questions of prospective applicants. You've written letters of recommendation, introductions, outreach essays, and blog posts. You've encouraged EVs to read at your events and said yes when we've asked you to read at ours. And to Dave Thomas, everything we know about public speaking, we learned from you. This is all just to say, thanks, LA. Sincerely.